Cheryl over here, by the way, on the end. And I teach at Rancho Valley College. Hannah's taking a class from me there. And the talk today is about climate change. And there will be PowerPoint later for you, PowerPoint enjoyers. So, but that's the last third. There's three things I want to do today, talking about climate change. One is the general idea, the general theory of climate change with the anthropogenic role in climate change. In other words, focusing on greenhouse gases and climate change, how that works. And then looking a little bit at Holden and climate change. And then jumping up one level from Holden to the Columbia River, and that's the PowerPoint that I have. It's about the Columbia River system and climate change, from a paper that Cheryl and I wrote a couple years ago. So I'll start with the obvious. Planet Earth is undergoing climate change, and it's certainly not the first time, okay? And already that's a jumping off point for those that may be more interested in denying climate change than studying climate change, that if it's changed in the past, so it must be changing itself again. What are we, it's got nothing to do with us. But the next point is that humans are becoming one of the dominant factors in the current climate change. So how would that be? Like, what was his name? Michael Crichton, that's his name, wrote a whole book arguing that a little bit of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere is not enough to do anything harmful. So I want to go over the very basics, because these things show up in articles in the newspaper or in documentaries about Al Gore, but I'm not sure they take it to a basic enough level. So here's a planet like the Earth, and it's got a star like the sun shining on it. And let's say you could just stick the Earth next to the sun and let the sun start shining on it. It's going to get warmed up by the radiation from the sun. Okay, so this is solar radiation, sunshine. But of course, solar radiation, it's energy, it's light, it's moving at the speed of light. It's not the particles that are going to warm the Earth significantly, not the solar wind, it's the solar radiation. It also includes other wavelengths besides visible light, such as infrared, ultraviolet, et cetera. Now the sun, because of the temperature it has at its surface, the sun puts out its greatest intensity of sunlight is the visible light range, okay? But it also puts out infrared and ultraviolet and so on. Now, by the way, let's start the Earth out with no atmosphere, okay? So the sunshine hits the Earth, all those wavelengths, visible and invisible, and some of it's going to get reflected off an Earth without an atmosphere, so we'll scatter some of it out. But a lot of it's going to get absorbed. Radiation is energy. When it gets absorbed, it can't just go away. It has to turn into some other form of energy. It turns into heat. It raises the temperature. Okay. So the radiation from the sun is going to warm up this Earth without an atmosphere, but it's not going to warm it infinitely until it melts and turns into vapor and disappears. The Earth itself, as it gets warmer, is going to radiate energy out until it reaches thermal equilibrium. And so every object with a temperature above absolute zero, which is basically every object, puts out some radiation. We all put out radiation. It's not visible radiation unless it gets hot enough, which we're not. The sun is, the Earth isn't, but we're putting out radiation and the Earth is putting out radiation. And so what happens is that the Earth will be taking energy in from the sun in the form of radiation, and eventually it'll reach a temperature where it'll put out an equal amount of its own radiation. And that temperature may be a relatively low medium temperature where it's mostly infrared radiation, okay? So once it's putting out enough infrared radiation to balance the radiation coming from the sun, it's at thermal equilibrium, and there it sits without, day and night the temperature will go up and down, and in the seasons the temperature from poles to equator to poles will change back and forth, but overall the average temperature will be reached where it's in thermal equilibrium. and that temperature would be about 0 degrees Fahrenheit, because it has no atmosphere. Okay? So the Earth is warmer than 0 degrees Fahrenheit because of its atmosphere. And so here's a basic question. Where does the air out here get its heat? Anybody care to venture an answer? You know that one? Yeah, from it gets it from the Earth. The air out here does not get heated by the sun. Why? How do I know that? Because it gets colder as I go up, and it has to be hotter at the source of the heat end. So the air out here does not get heated by, yes, it gets heated by the sun, because the Earth's surface is getting heated by the sun. So if you go back one more step, it's solar radiation that's heating the Earth's surface, but it's from the Earth's surface that the air out here is getting its heat. It's heated from the Earth up. So stick an atmosphere. Put an atmosphere around the Earth. And actually, it's the bottom. I'm not going to go into all the layers of the atmosphere. It's the bottom layer that goes up to about 6 miles high, where we live and where the mountains are. Top Mount Everest is almost sticking out of that bottom layer. But basically, it's the bottom layer that we have to be concerned about, because that's where we live. Anyway, that layer gets its heat from the Earth's surface in the form, largely, of infrared radiation. And the way that works is the infrared radiation is absorbed by what we're calling greenhouse gases. By the way, some of the heat goes up into the atmosphere a significant amount also. I wasn't going to mention this, but I will anyway. In the form of convection and other form of heat transfer, air rising up, air gets warmed up against the Earth's surface, rising up. But another significant component of it, of heat into this lower atmosphere, is in the form of infrared radiation, IR again, that doesn't make it through the atmosphere because of the greenhouse gases. Okay? These greenhouse gases, there's two things about them that make them work as greenhouse gases. They let the solar radiation in without absorbing a significant amount of it, because the sun's radiation is at shorter wavelengths that these gases don't absorb. Okay? But the Earth's infrared radiation is at wavelengths that they largely do absorb. Okay? So they let the sun in, it warms the Earth. The Earth puts its infrared radiation out. Much of that gets absorbed by these greenhouse gases. And that raises, to be absorbed, again, it's energy coming out of the Earth in the form of infrared radiation. It turns into heat in the atmosphere, and as the atoms move around faster. So with an atmosphere, this isn't the scale, and this is really just the lower atmosphere. The air temperature and the Earth's surface temperature end up a lot higher than it would be. Well, the Earth's surface temperature ends up a lot higher than it would be without the greenhouse gases. Because the average temperature on Earth is up around, 59, approaching 60 degrees Fahrenheit for the average overall temperature over the course of the year, over the whole face of the Earth, as opposed to down towards 0 degrees Fahrenheit. That's a big difference. I mean, without the greenhouse gases, if the Earth had water on it, it's an unrealistic situation. It does have an atmosphere. But if you could take away the greenhouse gases, the Earth would turn into, it would just be locked in ice. We wouldn't be here, basically. So, it's a common thing, and that up to a certain amount, greenhouse gases are good if we like the Earth the way it has been. And this is, it's very simple chemistry and physics, the way greenhouse gases work. It's not, you don't need to be an Einstein to work through this, although predicting in the future, that gets a little more tricky. But anyway, it's an easy prediction to make, is what I'm saying, that if something adds more greenhouse gases to the atmosphere, the temperature is going to go up. Okay? Now, one way to get at how true that prediction is, or how correct that prediction is to look at the Earth's past, and one of the best ways they've done it, how many people have seen An Inconvenient Truth? A couple of you. When Al Gore in that movie, leaving aside a couple of mistakes he made, he shows a record from where they drilled into the glaciers, like in Antarctica. The cool thing about glaciers is they accumulate a new layer of snow, which turns into ice every year, so you can drill down, pull those layers out, keep them frozen so they don't melt, and count back year by year and see how far in the past you are, and you can pull out little bubbles of trapped air, or work with the frozen water itself and the oxygen in it, H2O. But it also has, each layer has little bubbles of atmosphere that got trapped back then. So they can reconstruct. There's a thing they can do with the oxygen, the two types of oxygen, oxygen-16 and oxygen-18, to reconstruct past temperatures on Earth, whether it was in an ice age or not, or whether it was in a warm stage in between an ice age. This goes back up to over 700,000 years now, in the deepest drills and the deepest glaciers in Antarctica. And they can also see how much CO2 is in the atmosphere, carbon dioxide, which is a greenhouse gas. And they find, well, let me draw out this. I don't have this stuff on PowerPoint. Maybe that's okay. I'm like a much simplified drawing. But if you look at the trends of, okay, really simplified, CO2, temperature, delta T, which means temperature going up and down from some, like, take the average for the last 100 years and call that zero. So here's the modern average, I guess. And then this is time. How long ago? So here's today, zero. Here's 100, 200, 300, 400, 700,000 years ago. It goes something like this. Well, all right, this is going to be rougher than I thought, but it's not this smooth quite, but it's roughly 100,000 year interval with some smaller zigs and zags, and the temperature does the same thing. I got to fix one thing. Oops. I'm going to move this line up. This is the modern warm average. I better move it up. So this is a recent average temperature. So. They're in lockstep, or pretty close to it. Where this is up, where the CO2 is up, the average temperature on Earth is up. Where the CO2 is down, the average temperature on Earth is down. It's been happening that way for hundreds of thousands of years, and by more indirect evidence over the whole course of Earth history as far as we can determine it. But the best, most direct evidence comes out of the glacial ice cores. Okay. And the Earth has had, for the last couple million years, repeated glaciations in a big way, like covering much of Canada and all the way down into what's now the United States, and much of Northern Europe, you know, much more so than it has now, where it gets cold, but then it warms up for a while. And actually, well, this is where maybe PowerPoint would be good to show. It's not equally straight up and equally symmetric. It warms up quickly and cools off slowly each time. But leaving all that aside, looking into the past, the CO2 always correlates with the temperature on a global average. Now, in some cases, it looks like the CO2 doesn't go up or down until after the temperature's gone up or down, which leads into a chicken and egg kind of which is causing which question. But that may not be as important as the fact that they're always correlated, at least after a little bit of lifetime, of a few hundred years. Up to a couple thousand years in some cases, but usually they're pretty tight, like within a few decades. So in the past, when CO2 went up or down, so did the temperature. Oh, I better finish one more thing. For the last 700,000 years, the maximum CO2 was no more than 300 parts per million, which is what, 0.003% or 0.03%? Pretty small amount, but it was never more than that. Until the last 200 years, where it's gone up. So 300 parts per million, and now it's up around 400, do I remember this right? Oh, I'm forgetting the number. No, it's not 400, it's 385 parts per million. So maybe I raised that a little bit too much. So, all right. So why has it gone up lately? Well, mainly because of things people have been doing. Burning fossil fuels is the main thing. To a lesser extent, if a forest is cut down and much of the plant material decays or is burned, that turns carbon in plants back into CO2 in the atmosphere. So deforestation also adds to CO2 in the atmosphere.
Question.
Yeah.
Have there been studies that have attempted to correlate the variations in temperature historically over the last million years with other conditions that exist on the planet, such as water vapor, other physical parameters?
Yeah, there have. I'm not so sure.
Affected by solar radiation?
Yeah, well, okay, there's other factors in climate change include the shape of the Earth's orbit, tilt of the Earth's axis, where the Earth's axis points relative to its elliptical orbit. So there are these astronomical orbital factors. How hot the sun is shining, or how intensely the sun is shining, solar radiation, that can vary. How much plant life there is on Earth over the evolutionary course of Earth's history. As more plants have flourished, that may have at some stages have pulled down CO2 in the atmosphere. How much volcanoes are erupting. In the last century, volcanoes were only putting out a small fraction of the CO2 that we're doing by burning greenhouse gases. But there may have been times in the past when there was some bigger burps of volcanic gases going out. Methane, frozen on the floor of the ocean in some places, especially high up towards the poles, but in the ocean. There's a bunch of solid substances that have carbon and carbon dioxide kind of trapped in them, and that can be released suddenly at certain geologic stages, it seems to have happened, which would lead to a rapid warming. So all those other things can correlate with, they have a role in climate change, okay?
The water vapor one,
that one's more, I'm not so sure about that one. I mean, we know water vapor is a greenhouse gas. In fact, it's the most abundant greenhouse gas. There's a lot more water vapor in the atmosphere than there is carbon dioxide. But I'm not familiar, and I'm not deeply read in all the climate change literature, a moderate amount of it. I'm just not sure if anyone's figured out a way to get a handle on water vapor in the atmosphere over the last million years. There might be some ways that someone's tried to do that.
So I guess my question is, CO2 is being fingerprinted as the culprit. To what extent have the gamut of different
they measured all the
studied to correlate CO2?
They've also measured methane. It tends to go up and down somewhat like the CO2 does. That's a greenhouse gas. I don't think ozone would stay in those little trap bubbles in ice. It's not stable enough, so I don't think they were able to measure ozone, which is also a greenhouse gas, but it's also got a different effect up in the stratosphere. Let me put it this way. Any possible factor in climate change, a lot of effort's been put into trying to measure it and find out its record over the past. And the past megania, millions of years, past millennia, past century, and past 10 years. And the closer you get to the present, the more they've been able to measure it because people have been doing the studies directly with modern science. Water vapor and clouds and rain and snow, those are hard to get a handle on. But I don't think those are going to throw a wrench into the works, because if any greenhouse gas goes up, temperature should go up. And lately, CO2's been going up, and also methane was going up until about 5-6 years ago. Now it's kind of plateaued out. Ozone's been going up. That's a greenhouse gas. A few others have been going up. Nitrous oxide's been going up. That's a greenhouse gas. And at least several of those, if not all of them, are largely due to human release of gases from burning fossil fuels, burning coal, et cetera. So CO2 is the main one produced by human activities such as fossil fuel burning and deforestation. Some other things that humans do release other greenhouse gases into the air. And the thing is, water vapor, let me put it a different way. The amount of water vapor that's in the air finds its own limit because when it gets saturated, it precipitates out. So what determines the amount of water vapor in the air is the temperature of the Earth, which is determined by other things. I mean, the temperature of the atmosphere, which is determined by other things. A hotter atmosphere will have more water vapor in it. And that's a positive feedback effect, because then it gets hotter because of the greater amount of water vapor in it. Except when it condenses into clouds, which reflects sunlight from the upper side. And so the clouds, there was a woman I met who's a physicist who studies clouds. It's kind of one of the unsolved questions in climate change. If it weren't for clouds, we'd be in a runaway climate change effect. The increased temperature from increased CO2 from fossil fuel burning and so on would be would be allowing the atmosphere, would cause the atmosphere to take in more water vapor, which itself is a greenhouse gas, which would warm it even more, until eventually it turned into Venus or something. Fortunately, some of the water vapor turns into clouds and keeps it cooler by that way, but no one's figured out the exact equation for which, you know, whether it is acting as a positive feedback or if it's canceling out to neutrality. This is the other greenhouse gases we have to look at. But as far as I understand it, I'm pretty sure that even water vapor has a huge role, but when other greenhouse gases are changing, the water vapor goes along for the ride. The colder atmosphere takes in less water vapor, hotter atmosphere takes in more water vapor. So. Could the increase in CO2 in the last 200 years and 100 years and 10 years be due to other things besides fossil fuel burning? Maybe that's not even a question worth bringing up because, well, I'm deforestation a little bit. Oh, and also production of cement, which releases a lot of CO2. Well, cows release methane, mainly from their mouth, by their what do they call it? Their multiple stomachs. They are ruminants. They kind of burn it back up. So they're digesting all the vegetation in a way that produces mainly methane, which is another greenhouse gas. Mm-hmm. And it's not farts. It's mainly coming out the front end. It also comes out in the manure and so on, depending on how that's disposed of. But even as they're digesting, it's coming out of their chewing end.
Is that a significant?
Yes. According to another person I saw give a presentation, it's very significant. But I've seen some, one person in particular, put the number up around 40% of human additions of anthropogenic additions of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere being due to agricultural processes, largely livestock. But that's also because of how much of the deforestation, especially in tropical and subtropical countries, has to do with turning the land into livestock production. And so they're deforesting, and then they're putting in the cattle or other livestock, mainly cattle. But I think I've seen other papers that really argue with those numbers and knock it down to about 10% or 20%, as opposed to 40 to 50%. So it's significant, even if it's 10%. It might be more significant than that. But I'm more familiar with some papers that look at year by year what the CO2 level in the atmosphere is, and it is being tracked month by month, actually, in several places around the world, and has been for about right around 50 years. And they look at that, and they look at world sales of oil and gas and coal and the world economy, and they find a very statistically strong correlation between how much fossil fuels apparently being burned each year, and that goes up and down with economies and so on, and the rate of CO2 increase in the atmosphere. It's pretty much in lockstep with fossil fuel burning more than anything else. But the thing is, when coal is burned, when gasoline is burned, when natural gas is burned, when diesel is burned, it's always going to produce a lot of carbon dioxide. There's just no way around it. I mean, you can try and trap it and sequester it and stash it away somewhere where it's not going to get into the atmosphere. Coal, which is carbon, it's very simple. C plus O2 equals CO2. Gasoline also has a lot, and natural gas and so on also have a lot of hydrogen, so they produce CO2 plus H2O, two greenhouse gases. But the H2O, if there's too much in the atmosphere, it'll form clouds and precipitate out. So it's inevitable that burning all that fossil fuel in the last couple centuries, mainly in the last century, has added a lot of CO2 to the atmosphere, and it's obvious enough that it's not all come back out of the atmosphere, it keeps going up. Let me give you another number. About 50% of what is put into the atmosphere every year from fossil fuel burning gets absorbed mainly by the ocean, roughly half of it. So the ocean is doing a lot of absorption of greenhouse gas. It doesn't all stay in the atmosphere. And then the CO2 that does stay in the atmosphere, though, apparently it has a long residence time of on the order of a century or more. So if everyone stopped burning fossil fuel now, it would take at least a century, by some estimates several centuries, before it came back down to its pre-industrial levels. So it's not something we just turn off right away. I mean, if we put the, if we did some, find a way to put the brakes on for any fossil fuels, it's just going to keep things rising for a while, and there will be many generations in the future before they see it come back down, according to those estimates. Okay, but I've gone on too long about this one, perhaps. Well, maybe not. Any other questions? We only have so much time. The essential part is, of what I just went over, is that greenhouse gases work the way we understand them to work. There's really not much debate about that, at least in general. And if CO2 is going up in the atmosphere, it is. That's directly measured. And if most of that CO2 increase, perhaps all of it, is due to human activities, and it's hard to get around that, because otherwise, where's that CO2 going? And there's other ways. Actually, there's other ways of tracking where the CO2 is coming from, with carbon isotopes and so on. And it's been pretty well fingerprinted. The increase in CO2 is, I mean, burning fossil fuels, it doesn't just disappear into nothing. It's adding CO2 to the atmosphere, even though the ocean's absorbing a lot of it. There's a hope that more plants would start growing on Earth. I mean, for certain types of plants, in some situations, a more carbon dioxide-rich atmosphere will cause more plant growth, and that will pull it back out of the atmosphere. So far, that hasn't been seen significantly to be happening. You don't have to have much effect on the amount of carbon, added carbon dioxide in the air. But that sort of thing is still being studied, how much plants are absorbing in some places and other places where plants may not be doing so well as they used to, dying off and releasing carbon dioxide is a big research question these days. Okay. By my understanding of the physics and chemistry and the evidence that's been measured, there's no getting around an anthropogenic effect on climate change, which is adding to greenhouse gases, which is making the world a somewhat warmer place. Yeah.
Speaking of plants, have been looking in the oceans at the algae.
Oh, yeah.
And seaweed and underwater plant growth that
contribute. Yeah, well, much
oxygenation.
There's a lot. I mean, a lot of plankton in the ocean, and a few things attached to the bottom as well, live by photosynthesis. They're plants of some form. I think more so than on land in total. That's being studied. It can be measured by satellites, because the chlorophyll in the water and other things as a result of photosynthesis change the wavelengths of absorption and reflection of the ocean. So it's being tracked. Absorbing CO2. Some of the CO2 that's being absorbed by the ocean may be going into that process, must be going into that process. But I haven't seen, if it's changing from what it's been doing for the last century, I'm not aware of evidence of greater bioproductivity, greater plant growth in the oceans lately. And I think I have read some things about that. Another effect of more CO2 going into the oceans is greater acidity of the oceans, because it turns into carbonic acid, and that's been measured and seems to be happening in some parts of the ocean up to a couple tenths of a pH, which is fairly significant. Get it back out and screen up. But it's only in the last 30 years or so that this apparent, and to me it seems fairly strongly obvious, well not obvious, but fairly becoming more clear, anthropogenic effect through greenhouse gases mainly on climate change has become hard to get around. Because there are changes in solar radiation. I mean, how strong the sun's shining, and those are being tracked much better the last 50 years than 50 years before that than in previous centuries. There are measurements of volcanic gases coming out. I mean, all those other factors are being measured. And up until about 30 years ago, most of the ups and downs in global average temperature could be largely accounted for by those other factors, those natural factors, non-human factors. But then, starting about 30 years ago, the Earth's orbital variations should be cooling the Earth off or not changing the temperature. They're not causing climate change. Volcanic emissions of CO2 are insignificant. They're not causing the CO2 to go up. I mean, they're slightly significant, but they're an order of magnitude smaller than human emissions. The solar radiation up until recently, well, actually, it's been stuck kind of low the last couple of years. But it doesn't solar radiation hasn't been going up as temperature has lately. So these other factors, no one's been able to put their finger on any other factor, any natural factor, that could be accounting for the last 30 years of increased average temperatures. And that's just sort of a sideways check of the basic idea that as CO2 goes up, it'll be getting warmer, and up until recently, that's been the case. Sorry for this. I was going to talk about Holden. Okay, let me mention a couple things about climate change around here. My strongest familiarity with climate change in the Cascades comes from research this not very widely known professor at Nichols College in Massachusetts has been doing for 26 years now. He and grad students and so on have been coming up and measuring a selection of glaciers around the North Cascades. Not every one of them, they can only do so much. And when he first started it, I've seen him give a talk, Cheryl and I have, and I've read some of his papers. He didn't necessarily know what he was getting into in the long run, that this would become a climate change proxy in a way, his studies of these glaciers. But anyway, all the glaciers have been retreating, shrinking, and some of the smaller, lower ones have disappeared in those 25 years. In the last 2 years, I will mention this because you'll see this in letters to the editor from those who argue against global warming as a process that humans might be involved in. That for 2 years, the last 2 years, the global average temperature has not gone up. And more Pelto's data, the last 2 years, the glaciers haven't retreated significantly. So does that mean we don't have to worry anymore and it's over? The answer is no, because it's a climate question, and 2 years doesn't make a climate. You have to look at 10, 20, 30, 50 year trends. So, in fact, any climate change I've ever seen a year by year record of, like global average temperatures, it never just goes one way. It's always got zigs and zags. So, if we may be just in a zig right now where it's not going up for a few years. Another interesting thing going on right now is, has anyone heard about this? The solar sunspot cycle? Every 11 years, the sun builds up more and more sunspots, which changes about 1%. The amount of radiation intensity it's putting out, which is starting to become significant, 1%. And then it flips its magnetic field around, and it starts that cycle over every 11 years. Not exactly 11 years, but pretty close. It's almost like clockwork. But coming out of its last sunspot cycle, it's been starting the next one really slowly, like it's a year behind schedule for the number of sunspots it has, which means it's not putting out as much radiation as it normally would be in its normal stage, in its normal behavior during the sunspot cycle. So if the sun were to stay that way forever, that might be convenient for us because it would mean it would help cool the Earth off a little bit. But we have no one's got any theoretical reason to think it's going to stay that way. And there have been some sunspots observed lately, just a little bit, but it's still behind the density of sunspots it normally has at this stage in its schedule. So the sun has been acting a little bit weird lately compared to the previous 150 years of being observed. And that might correlate, that might be at least a partial explanation for why there's been this last 2 years of not increased average temperature. But again, through the 20th century, some of the ups and downs could be ascribed to solar radiation variation. But by the end of the 20th century, the greenhouse gas effect was starting to swamp that. And I think even if the sun stopped having sunspots for some strange reason and stayed where it is now, not quite as hot as it gets at the end of the sunspot cycle, well, eventually we'll go back to warming anyway from that new average of solar radiation if the greenhouse gas keeps going up and if all that greenhouse gas theory is correct and it keeps increasing. So we're in an interesting stage right now where a lot of letters are being written saying, apparently it's all, we're not going to worry about it anymore, but I don't think that's the case. We're mixing up weather or 1 or 2 years with climate in that case. Okay, Holden. The glaciers are retreating around here, and anyone who's been here more than a few years and gone hiking up to where you see the glaciers has eventually probably noticed that they are shrinking, even visibly within a 5 to 10 year scale, you start to see that around here. And the argument for why that must be caused by higher average temperature rather than less average precipitation, because the amount of precipitation has not been dropping. It's just been turning more liquid and less solid, less snow, more rain, which is due to warmth, not due to lower precipitation mass. So that it's a warming effect. It's not a lower precipitation effect. You don't have to go look very far to verify that. So the glaciers are indicating at least North Cascades warming for the last 25 years, up until the last 2 years. And I keep telling journalists, I'm eager to see, I mean, they're just finishing up their field work of measuring the glaciers this summer. I don't know if they've retreated. I'm being really bad here. For the theory to be correct, I want them to have retreated, but for the good of the world, it's better for not having this climate change of global warming. So, but nonetheless, I expect that in the long run, within a few more years, we're going to see a lot more glacial retreat. Maury Pelto does think that even if greenhouse gases keep increasing to about 550 parts per million, the highest, biggest glaciers will still stick around in a slightly reduced form. He doesn't think we're going to lose all of them completely, just the small, low ones and maybe up to some point. But he thinks that the Cascades get high enough to retain a few glaciers even in a warmer climate, even though we're starting to lose some of them. And then, we've heard by word of mouth that the Science and Technology Committee here in Holden Village, someone, and they know of someone or someone in their group, or they had someone do a study of Copper Basin Glacier. What would happen to hydroelectricity production over here if all the glaciers disappear from Copper Basin? And they concluded there would not be a significant reduction in hydroelectricity production. I haven't talked to the original person. This is just an anecdote. I'm not sure what word make of it. So I'll have to ask around about it and see. It might not be published.
So the snowfall itself would be enough to produce enough for hydroelectricity?
Well, when rivers keep flowing and streams around here, late in the summer, even after the snow has melted, there's two sources, glaciers, but in a lot of basins, even without glaciers, it's groundwater.
Okay.
And so my guess is they're thinking that there'll still be enough water getting into the ground even if the glaciers are gone. And they're thinking that's the main source of late summer water flow, more so than the glaciers melting. And the other thing is that the lowest electricity production around here is in the winter, when there's so much freezing that not much water comes down the creek. The warmer the winters are and the more we have rain instead of snow, the more they're going to get late fall, winter, and early spring hydroelectricity. So in a way, for their low electricity production seasons, it might be a benefit to have a warmer climate around here, in a way, as far as electricity production goes in the winter. So I'll be interested to find out more about that. But I only brought it up to see if anyone else knew of any source of more information on that. I just need to ask around more. Okay, but some other things that may already be happening and are predicted, at least by some, to be a result of climate change that includes warmer average temperatures that are particularly relevant to the North Cascades include increased risk of wildfires and insect infestations, and maybe other types of infestations, fungi and so on, affecting the forest, the trees, such as the spruce budworm, has been wiping out a lot of the spruce trees around here. Because it's generally thought, at least by a lot of entomologists, that with warmer winter average temperatures, more of the spruce budworm population survives over and does better than if you get more deep freezes in the winter. So, I mean, that's not the only factor in the population of spruce budworm. It's an ecological thing, but in general, if the world gets warmer, there's going to be a lot of changes in which species. I mean, that's one of the factors in an ecosystem and in which species are in species populations in a given area is temperature and climate. And if the climate changes, then we'll see some shifts in the species. And during the change, it's kind of a disequilibrium process, there'll be some competitions and shifting back and forth, possibly new species coming in, possibly some species moving further north into Canada, whether it's insects or plants or even mammals of certain types. So in general, we can predict these changes. The details, we can't always put our fingers on it until we see it happening. And ultimately, there may be some species extinctions as well, if there haven't been already, due to or at least aided and abetted by climate change. But that's more off in the future, perhaps, most of that happening. Those studying climate change and predicting into the future, there's this standard, and you might have heard of this, before the 1700s or before the 1800s, the average carbon dioxide in the atmosphere was around 285 parts per million for millennia, for thousands of years, not much change. And now it's up to 385, I think it is. Well, so it, at that rate, within a certain amount of time, it could double. In fact, it could double to 570 parts per million by 2060, 2070 at the current rate, within the century, double the pre-industrial amount. So, and it's not a linear thing. Eventually, more carbon dioxide isn't going to absorb more infrared radiation. The molecules that are already there are doing everything the carbon dioxide can. So if you quadrupled it, it may not warm. If in an imaginary Earth, I don't think this would really happen, I hope, if CO2 in the atmosphere got quadrupled, it wouldn't cause four times as much warming as doubling it does. Because by the time you get that high, it's not, increased carbon dioxide is not doing that much more absorption of infrared radiation. The ones that are already there are catching most of it already. I think that within their wavelengths, that carbon dioxide can catch. So, brings up another bad thought of mine. Maybe we could just deal with the hotter world and then it doesn't matter how much CO2 we put in once it's reached its maximum absorption. But that might be a thoroughly different loss of species extinct world. Yeah.
Right. Is the carbon dioxide thought to be holding the heat in, eating at the ozone layer?
No, it holds the heat in. As a greenhouse gas, the more greenhouse gas there is in the atmosphere up to sort of an asymptotic limit, the warmer the atmosphere will be.
So it's creating a false ozone layer?
There is a role for the ozone layer, which is mainly the stratosphere in all this, but that's kind of beside the point, really, for the greenhouse gases. Because we're talking, the ozone layer is up the bottom, the next layer up is the stratosphere. The greenhouse gas effect is primarily in the troposphere, but it's lower layer, the real life. Ozone itself is a greenhouse gas, and it's increased by pollution such as car exhaust down here at ground level. So it does have but it's a small role to play as far as greenhouse gases go. So CO2 and methane and nitrous oxide are doing more absorption and have been added more to the atmosphere by human activities than ozone lately.
So technically we could inject ozone into that layer and fill the gaps, or?
No. Well, ozone is not a greenhouse gas. Ozone's unique. Well, ozone's got its own special characteristics, depending on where it is. A true greenhouse gas lets solar radiation in with shorter wavelengths. It absorbs infrared radiation from the Earth, trying to get out, and it has longer wavelengths, and infrared radiation. That's what greenhouse gases do. Ozone absorbs both. Ozone absorbs shortwave radiation from the sun coming in. That's what the ozone layer up in the stratosphere is doing. And it also absorbs infrared radiation from the Earth getting out. So if there's more ozone down here near the Earth's surface, it's acting as a greenhouse gas. There's more ozone up in the stratosphere, it's acting to absorb more ultraviolet radiation from the sun, which is a different thing. So, which has a slight cooling effect, but not much. I mean, it doesn't add much to the ozone that's already up there. And ozone is kind of its own question, its own problem that already pretty much has its own resolution, where the countries of the world have pretty much agreed to stop producing chlorofluorocarbons, and for the most part that seems to be, we're on a good trend towards having that problem solved, if it keeps up. So, okay, we can say more about Holden. So, you know, you see dead spruce trees around here from spruce budworm, many of them. That might be partly because of warmer winters. The glaciers are also telling us there are warmer winters and hotter summers around here. But, you know, I wouldn't claim to know for sure that that's completely because of climate change. There are other factors in things like spruce budworms thriving. But it's just if CO2 increase keeps going on and other greenhouse gases, it keeps getting warmer, I think we'll just see more and more things where we can start to definitely say, well, these problems are definitely related. These species problems, these trees dying, these fires burning, sounds kind of apocalyptic, problems. But I mean, I don't want to make it too extreme sounding. It's a gradual thing, but eventually it may add up to a lot if climate change continues to warm things around here. Let's see. Okay, for the time remaining, I'm going to run through some slides from this paper that Cheryl and I put together on the Columbia River, which this is a tributary to. Railroad Creek and Copper Creek are tributaries to. So that's why I was pretty interested, I just have to ask more people, about this, the lack of effect on the hydroelectricity production of the glaciers melting. Oh, but first, Paul, I don't know Paul's last name, the white-haired gentleman who, was it?
Weidland,
who led the Central Lutheran group here. He gave me this slide. This is his slide. And this is, he likes this saying. He gave me the story about how physicists would look at it and say it's statistically unsound, and chemists would look at it and say, that can't be right. You have to rewrite your reaction. And geologists would look at it and say, it looks good to me. Let's go have a beer. But what this is attempting to do is show a possible correlation between CO2 in the atmosphere since 1880. This is from glacial ice cores up to the late 1950s, and then it's been directly measured since then. So this is CO2.
What is the Mauna Loa?
Mauna Loa is in the late 1950s, a chemist named Keeling, is it Paul Keeling? Charles Keeling, who was a new professor at Caltech. He decided to start measuring CO2 in the atmosphere, and he picked Mauna Loa in Hawaii because his calculation showed that if at that elevation, around 13,000 feet, and upwind from the main volcanic part of the island, he would get a well-mixed sample of the troposphere, the lower atmosphere. And so he started doing that in 1959, and he measured it several times a month and got a monthly average every month. And he and then later other helpers have done it ever since, that same station. Since then, other people in other parts of the world have started making similar measurements, and they all plot within a couple percent of what he's been getting on Mauna Loa. So it's been verified as a good measurement of the global average lower atmosphere carbon dioxide. So he passed away recently, or a couple years ago. But it's because of his measurements. I mean, he had a lot of these measurements he was making. They started to get a lot of notice as people saw right away that was going up and up, year by year. Okay, and then this is global average temperatures reconstructed from weather instruments around the world with a lot of statistical work to try and average it out into a global average temperature. And they're all over the place, up and down. Here from around 1940 to from the late 1930s to the 1970s, there was this pot, you know, it looked kind of like global cooling for a while, if you average through all the peaks and valleys. But since then, it's gone up to mostly increasing. So, you know, these are degrees Fahrenheit for the blue graph. That's over here. The temperatures are in blue. Around 56.7 or 8 to begin with. And then now up to around 58, so something like a couple degrees Fahrenheit of temperature increase. But it's never smooth. There's a lot of up and down, year by year. Okay, I got that from Paul. But to switch to this other thing I was going to talk about, the Columbia River. And I won't go over everything we had to say about this because we're running out of time, I think. Okay, the Columbia River system, it's a fully utilized resource. There's only one other place they might be able to put a dam in on the Columbia River, although there's not a really good place to put a dam there. There's only one 10-mile or maybe 20-mile stretch of the Columbia River left that isn't a part of a reservoir behind the dam. It's basically, at least on the main stem, Columbia River. So it's a fully utilized resource in terms of irrigation, hydroelectricity, et cetera. It supports much of the region's economy. Boeing in Seattle is partly because of the Columbia River. All that electricity made for cheap aluminum and cheap electrical power, which led to airplanes being built economically profitably in Seattle over the mountains. But also in eastern Washington, a lot of the economy, agriculture, and so on, depends on the Columbia River. Okay, climate change. Now here's the case I'm making. And we can't quite prove it. This is a little bit of a for argument thing. It will reduce this resource, at least reduce the reliability of this resource. I think we can make that case pretty well. It's likely to reduce electricity and irrigation. That's why I'm interested in their conclusion about Copper Creek hydroelectricity not going down. And raise water temperature. That's already happening. It's been measured for decades, and it's going up in the Columbia River. And it will threaten salmon survival. Climate change will. All right, so when Cheryl and I started looking into this almost 3 years ago, you know, it seemed like it was important for people involved with the Columbia River as a resource, or as a source of water, or as a source of electricity, or even as a source of recreation, or as a place for fish to survive. They needed to start looking into this, and there wasn't much looking into it yet. Since then, some of the utility companies and the Bonneville, the main power hydroelectricity managing part of the Columbia River system is the Bonneville Power Administration. And they've started looking into it more than they had 2.5 years ago, anyway. All right. Now, the Columbia River, it's the biggest river in Western North America or Western South America. It's the biggest river that empties into the Pacific Ocean on the coast of either of the Americas. It's not as big as the Mississippi River or the Missouri River, but it's the biggest one in the West in terms of the amount of water flowing through each year. And it has a big basin. All the water within these red lines ultimately goes out the Columbia River into the Pacific Ocean. So it's all part of the Columbia River Basin, including the whole Snake River part of it. That's a tributary of the Columbia River, the biggest tributary of the Columbia River, and the Willamette River in Oregon, and et cetera. And it's got a really weird path up into Canada and back, just about. All right, so it's a huge river system. It's got a steep gradient, and it's got a lot of places where the valley's fairly narrow. So between flowing down steeply and having a narrow valley in many places, it's a great river to dam, because that steep gradient means a lot of potential, a lot of energy is there in terms of gravitational potential energy. And then the places where the valley is narrow makes it easy to put a dam in. So certainly that's been taken advantage of. I should mention that it's a snow-fed river, so it flows at its during the spring, late in spring, when the snow is melting at its fastest in the mountains, the river gets a lot more water than it does the rest of the year. Other rivers outside of snowy, mountainous, glaciated areas have a different annual flow pattern. But this one's a snow-fed river system. Okay, let's see. Here's some of the dams. These are 40 biggest dams on the Columbia River, like Grand Coulee, et cetera, on down the river, and the Snake River, and some of the other tributaries. Oops, Snake River down here. And on up into Canada, and et cetera. It's got a lot of big dams. Most of these, not quite all of them, are getting hydroelectricity. Some of them are just for flood control and or irrigation. I guess the big ones that are on there, if they're not doing hydroelectricity, their reason for being there is for flood control. But most of them are also producing hydroelectricity, many of them in a big way, like Grand Coulee Dam. So it's a very modified, engineered river system. It's not very much in its natural state anymore. And there have been books written about it, and at least here in the Pacific Northwest, we still hear those Woody Guthrie songs about the Roll On Columbia, Roll On, and so on, where it's celebrated as it's a big engineering accomplishment, a big development accomplishment that grew the whole, in many ways, helped grow the economy into its modern form in Eastern and even Western Washington and Oregon. The system of the Columbia River hydroelectricity still usually has a surplus of electricity that we sell all the way down to California and Arizona, where they sell. I live around here, so I say we. So it's used to produce a lot of electricity. Cheryl and I live in a place that has, the second lowest electric rates. We don't pay very much for our electricity because we live next to the Columbia River. Agriculture, behind Grand Coulee Dam, they pump water out. That up here into a big reservoir that feeds gravitationally down across a big part of eastern Washington. Shipping, the dams, not Grand Coulee, but further downstream, the dams have allowed barges and tugboats to move up and down the river in a reliable way with locks to lift them up and down around the dams, although not Grand Coulee Dam. Now, biodiversity. The dams, anyway, have not been good for biodiversity, or they've altered it to the detriment of the native species and the good of a few introduced species. But the mission that the running of the Columbia River is charged with now is to preserve as much as possible biodiversity partly through the Endangered Species Act. So it wasn't part of the intent of building the dams, but now the people in charge of managing the flow of the Columbia River through the dams and so on are supposed to preserve the biodiversity. And then recreation. People want to go boating, people want to go fishing or swimming. They can use these reservoirs. All right. Now there's a couple other big river system and water system developments in the American West that are also famous and huge. One is the Colorado River, from Colorado down through the Southwest, and then California with this huge, mainly for the Los Angeles area, but it's huge water diversion and development. So they've all got their own style. Lately, of course, China is finishing its construction of the Three Gorges Dam, which dwarfs Grand Coulee Dam. And actually, that's a multiple dam system in China. They're trying to leap beyond the scale of what we've done with the Columbia River in terms of taking advantage of water as a resource. And they may be having some of the same negative outcomes as well as positive outcomes. Okay, salmon in the Columbia River. The Indians that lived along the Columbia River, this was their number one protein source, and they would dry it and preserve it for the winter as well. Salmon, there's several species. Salmon, in general, are hatched in fresh water, up rivers or all the way up into lakes at the end of the rivers, depending on the species. And then they're born, and within a certain amount of time, they make their way down to the ocean, where they grow to adult size with a lot of muscle. That is a lot of potential fish meat, fish to eat. I'm revealing my love for salmon in the consumption way there. Anyway, and then they swim back up river to where they, usually to close to where they were born, or at least the same branch of the river, and lay some eggs and get them fertilized, and most species then die. Steelhead can do it several times. And there's a few landlocked forms that have become separated from the ocean, but most of them, I mean, they're anadromous. They're born in freshwater, go to the sea, grow up, and come back to the freshwater to hatch. Okay, and the Columbia River was a huge salmon river. I mean, with all those tributaries and in this climate, with the Pacific Ocean having more species of salmon than the Atlantic Ocean by a long shot, I mean, the Columbia River was quite the producer of salmon. But of course, that was an economic opportunity that was pretty quickly taken advantage of once Europeans and European Americans arrived in the area. So there was a big plummet in the abundance of salmon even before the first dams were being built, just by fishing or overfishing. And then the dams started being built in the 1920s and 1930s, and the salmon populations kept going down for the most part. And then the Endangered Species Act was passed in the 1970s, and that's led to attempts at keeping the salmon population from declining all the way down to zero. Now, some of these species live on other rivers down to California, or at least used to be, or up to Alaska and all the way over to Russia. But the Endangered Species Act requires preservation of subspecies that are unique, and I mean, I don't know the complete legal and biological definitions, but it's not just the whole species. So the runs on the Columbia River are supposed to be preserved and kept from going extinct. And there's been a lot of money, and every year there is a lot of money being spent on the Columbia Rivers and all its tributaries and the dams and so on to try and get the salmon to be able to pass through and live. And there's also hatcheries where they artificially take eggs and fertilize them and raise them a little bit and release them into the rivers to keep the numbers high for people fishing or for maybe the salmon themselves as a subspecies to survive. There's problems with that, especially when they take salmon from one river and move them to another for the hatchery. And there's other problems as well, possible problems with the hatchery situation. In some cases, they take the smolt, the little salmon, on their way down to the river. They put them in barges and take them around Snake River dams, at least in some cases. And they don't want the salmon to go through the turbines where the electricity is being generated, because they get ground into pulp in some cases. Actually, I think some of them actually go through there and live, but most of them don't when they get into the turbine system. So they've got these bypasses for little salmon going down. And then for the adults to swim back up, they've got these fish ladders. Okay, this is Bonneville Dam, to let them back up. And now once you get to Chief Joseph Dam, about 50 miles, 60 miles from here, maybe not that far. There are no more fish ladders. There are no salmon on the upper two-thirds of the Columbia River because they don't allow fish passage up there anymore. All right. So back to this point. The Columbia River is pretty much tapped out, at least if we're going to also keep species alive in it. There's not much more that can be done with it in terms of using it as a resource. Now, these are quotes we took from some of the Bureau of Reclamation and other federal level developers of the Columbia River. But going back to Franklin D. Roosevelt, one of their goals was, it was a little bit socialistic, you could say, total use for greater wealth, ideally for everybody, to, you know, raise the standard of living for everyone. And you can make the argument that to some extent it did that, from the farmer who got electricity from rural electrification to the person working in the factory with the aluminum production and so on, and beyond that. All right, now there's no single entity in charge of the Columbia River system. Someone was telling me they read in a story about, if you follow a salmon swimming upstream to spawn from the Columbia River all the way up, say, most of the way up the Snake River, it goes through so many government jurisdictions and entities that are in control of this part of it and this part of it, or at the same time with overlapping control of it. So it's kind of hard to keep it organized. In terms of hydroelectricity and flow of the river, that's mainly the Bonneville Power Administration. I mean, they can turn it on and off at each dam up to a certain point, or they can help coordinate how that happens. But they're not really in charge of everything, which is different from the Tennessee Valley Authority. The Tennessee River system back east was also turned into a huge hydroelectric and other resource use project by the federal government starting back in the 1930s under Roosevelt. But there they put a single entity totally in charge of the river, kind of from top to bottom, beginning to end. So it's got more big brother, centralized control on the Tennessee Valley Authority and the Tennessee River than the Columbia River does. Also, the Columbia River is international. It goes up into Canada, and that adds to complexity in how it's run. And these goals, I mean, ideally we can work them all out and satisfy to some extent each of these goals that are supposed to be met: flood control, hydropower, irrigation, salmon and other species, and recreation. But they do compete in some ways, because salmon, the little salmon going downriver, mainly in the, depending on which species, summer to spring, summer and fall, but mainly in the spring, they need a big flow of the river, like it normally has, left to its own devices, in the late spring, okay? But for irrigation and for hydroelectricity, they want to save a lot of that big flow of the spring, put it behind the dam reservoirs and store it for production of electricity, for irrigation the rest of the summer, in the late summer when there isn't so much flow of water in the river, and for hydropower the rest of the year, through the winter. So the more they store water for these uses in the spring when the river would be flowing fastest, the less salmon are going to make it down to, the fewer salmon are going to make it down to the ocean. So they got to try and balance that out. But it's a competing thing to a large extent. All right. Climate change effects. Some of these have already been observed, and others are forecast or predicted. So higher air temperature, the Pacific Northwest has a higher air temperature more so than the world average by a couple tenths of a degree in the last 130 years or so. So that's been happening. Water temperature, too. In the Columbia River, just about in parallel with air temperature, water temperature has been going up, which could be a big problem for salmon, which I'll mention again in a minute. Less snow in the mountains, because with warmer temperatures, you get fewer days when it snows and more days when it rains over the course of fall, winter, spring. That, to some extent, has been happening, although it's very erratic and not a very consistent trend, and it's forecast as well. Now, melting of glaciers, no one forecast that. Maybe it was too obvious. I don't know. But it has been observed to be happening. At least no one I've been able to find forecasted. Now, and the reduction in the peak runoff, that's right, that is forecast. Because with less snow in the winter, there's less of a peak flow in the spring when the snow is melting. And that's already been observed, and it's already moved several days on the average earlier into the spring as well, when the peak snow melt occurs, because it's hotter earlier. That's this one here, earlier spring freshet. That's already been observed, and if climate gets warmer, it'll keep getting earlier. Okay, reduced total annual discharge. The total amount of water that flows down the Columbia River each year has gone down in the last century on the order of 15%. Nobody has an explanation. It's not predicted by climate change studiers, although it may be a detail that they can't get out of their models yet. So what that means, I don't know, but it's, apparently it's been happening. It kind of goes against some forecasts, which was we might have more rain and more precipitation overall, but that hasn't been the way it's gone in the last century, or the last 80 years or so. Increased fall and winter runoff, where it's coming down as rain instead of snow more, that's been happening, and it can be expected to keep happening more if temperatures get warmer. And then this is more extreme weather events or short-term climate events like droughts. Anyway, more floods and more droughts. It's not clear that that's been occurring yet, but some climate models for the future predict that more of that will be happening. Yeah.
Seems that one of the most unpredictable parts is what will be the effect of global climate change in any one region of the planet.
Yeah.
And what we see in the short run may be very different in the long run, even if temperatures are increasing, because of the change of both ocean flow and air flow, I guess.
Yeah, it is hard. But if we allow for some possible correctness in the end of some of these models, when they do run it, like for a doubled CO2 atmosphere, where there's a couple more, two or three more degrees of average warming around the world, then some countries and some regions in some countries may like it better. They may grow more plants. They may, the river flow may not change significantly. Whereas others may have some great problems. And so, and that leads to the idea of climate refugees, people moving from places that were kind of on the edge anyway, in terms of temperatures and water supplies, and then it knocks them over the edge to where fewer people can survive there. Whereas other places, like maybe Canada, perhaps even more so than the US, start doing even better for them. They have a longer growing season. More people are willing to move there because the winters are shorter.
Do you see where, are there models for that kind of projection? Do scientists have a sense that they're getting a better sense about accurate predictions around what areas will be affected by what, or is it too complex?
Well, I don't know if it's been long enough now to see if these predictions are coming out yet. And the main source of, including a whole bunch of references that aren't part of the paper itself, is the International Panel on Climate Change. It's coordinated through the UN, but it's got on the order of a couple thousand scientists, many of them climatologists, putting together that stuff and putting forward their best models and predictions, and then references to their publications are in there in the details at the end. And some of that's in there. Some of that last report, from what was it, 2007, include forecasting effects by region or by country or by section of the world, where it's going to be worse for some areas and maybe and not so bad, or even slightly beneficial in terms of agriculture, say, for others. That's it. So that's in there. So that's the first thing. I'd refer you to that, and you can look up counter arguments maybe on Google to that as well. But as far as scientific goes, a pretty good summary of that would be in the last IPCC report that's available online. Thousands of pages of, well, not thousands, hundreds of pages of it available online. All right, we're almost done. This is Maury Pelto. Now, this was 2006. Okay, that guy from Nichols College back in Massachusetts who comes out here every summer to measure the glaciers. See, when he first was doing it, starting back in 1984, the glaciers weren't shrinking that much, although they were starting to. But then they really started dropping off in the 1990s. Now, 2007, 2008, it's like this. They haven't been significantly advancing or retreating. So there's a little, but you know, that's been the case. Like, look here, 1, 2, 3, 4 years of slight advance, but it's still part. But back then, anyway, it was still part of an overall glaciers retreating trend. So I'm thinking that will probably be the case for the last couple of years. If we look 10 years from now,
meters of thickness.
It's the volume. Cumulative. It's a meter. It's a meters cube. Meters cubed, so it's a volume thing. And you'd have to read the paper. This happened last time I showed this. I forgot the details from the paper, and then I'm supposed to look it up in the meantime. But I think these are fairly commonly used among glaciologists for glacial mass balance. Mass balance is at the end of the melting season, towards the end of the summer, well, you can pick which time you want to do it to, but that's what he's doing in this case. What is the balance between amount of new snow accumulated versus amount of ice melted and sublimated and lost in one form or another? So they do the balance, and if it comes out negative, that means the glacier's shrinking. And it's done in some sort of cubic, I think cubic meters would be the standard scientific form. But there's some meters, I'm not sure what all the BN and the WE stand for.
But how does this relate to the total extent of all the glaciers here? I mean, this is,
there's not one that he's been studying that it hasn't been shrinking. But the highest elevation, biggest glaciers haven't been shrinking as much percent-wise compared to their total volume. So it's like the vulnerable glaciers were the lower, smaller ones, and some of them have disappeared completely already, a few of them, during this 25-year study. Other people have started, not 25 years ago, but more recently, studying glaciers up in the Canadian Rockies that also feed into the Columbia River, and they find at least up until a couple years ago, they were retreating as well. And let's see. Is that helping?
Yeah, it's just the, I took a class in how to lie with statistics, and always have difficulty looking at these charts.
Well, what?
Trying to correlate this with the big picture.
Well, I picked this one because this is the summary chart. They've added up all the couple of dozen or whatever it is glaciers they're studying, and this is the cumulative mass balance from all those glaciers. Okay, now, and the reason I mentioned that all of them are retreating is because maybe this is hiding the fact that in some places they're advancing, other places they're retreating, but all of them are retreating at least to some extent. So the summary trend is not that different from a lot of the trends on the individual glaciers. But since I can't even explain what the BN and WE stand for, maybe you shouldn't give it too much credence at this point. But he puts most of this information up online. If you look up Mari Pelto or Nichols College Glacier Studies, you can find this stuff online. So, and he's published a number of papers as well. Okay, so looking into the future, climate change effects on the river, it kind of repeats what we had before, but there'll be less irrigation water in the late summer, and therefore less agricultural income. Because more water comes down in the spring, the spring freshet won't be freshing things up as much on this snowmelt-fed river. And then our prediction, at least my prediction, I don't know if Cheryl would say she was part of this, as less hydropower will result. This is a little bit of a going out on a limb and not a very good prediction to make because I don't have a strong scientific base. It's just an empirical basis. The amount of flow down the Columbia River has been going down. So even though we don't have a complete explanation for that, if that's related to climate change and it keeps going down, well then that supports these first 2 points. Question over here. But I want to leave time for questions, so I'm going to kind of whip through this. At any rate, the hydrology of the river will change to some extent, and that's going to change the way they produce hydropower, the way they plan how to produce it each month, and so on. And if the total flow of the river keeps going down, that's less hydropower. There's a point there. It impacts the salmon in a negative way. Greater fall winter flooding. Now, not on the Columbia River, but other rivers in the Northwest. Well, no, we can't. Flooding's happened in the past, and no one's been able to demonstrate that the frequency of flooding has been going up lately for Pacific Northwest rivers. That may be a more long-term thing before we know if that really is happening or not. Droughts, every time there is a big drought on some part of the Columbia River system, they lose a lot of money in agriculture. The last big drought in the Yakima Valley area lost tens of millions of dollars worth of agricultural production. So if there are more longer enduring droughts, that's going to be another problem for agricultural income and lower electricity production, more wildfire and insect, etc. Droughts, several papers have been put forth arguing that if you look at the big droughts in the Pacific Northwest that we have a historical record of, they're a good proxy for a warmer climate with double the amount of CO2. And it's not, it'll be a problem. Finally, higher water temperatures, that'd be particularly, put salmon particularly at risk. Salmon are cold water fish for the most part. Once it gets too warm, they don't make it anymore. And it's trending fairly, some of those temperatures are already occurring in the summertime. Part of that has to do with the dam reservoirs heating the water up as well. But all right. So sustainable development, get together, talk about it, find solutions, and conserve resources, and go from there. We'll leave it at that and take questions. So the Columbia, I picked the Columbia River, I think, is an example of how different regions of the world that, I mean, the world is partly geographical, and resources that we use are going to be affected by climate change to some extent. Leaving aside solving climate, if humans are contributing to the climate change, leaving aside what we can do to counteract that, just dealing with it is going to take some adjustments in some of these resource uses. Yeah.
What is your, shall I say, generic response to the people who say that the models aren't reliable in predicting many aspects of this, so it's not mankind caused?
Well,
it's natural.
I would say I'm only halfway agreeing with that. Models are not going to perfectly predict the future.
Right, yeah.
But the models have been doing a good job of explaining the past. They match. And like I said, trying to look into every factor that could be causing climate change, no one's been able to find a way of getting the last 30 years, at least, of global warming to happen without it being mainly due to greenhouse gases. So that's not uncertain. If we go into the past, even just 5, 10, 30 years, there's not much uncertainty there about what's a big factor in the global temperature, especially the increase, which is increased greenhouse gases, and it comes back at least largely to humans. As for what's going to happen in the future, some unexpected things may happen, but leaving aside plants deciding to grow more, they won't just decide. It just seems, or meteorite impact, or the Earth running into a bunch of dust in space, or the sun deciding not to produce sunspots anymore. Leaving aside those things, if everything else continues along like it has, and humans keep on producing more greenhouse gases, especially carbon dioxide, then it's going to get warmer. I mean, how much it's going to get warmer, that is uncertain. 1 to 5 degrees warmer if the trends continue for the next 50 years. And pick your units, I don't care if it's Fahrenheit or Celsius, I'll say 1 to 5 degrees. I'd say a little bit less in Celsius, perhaps. It's pretty rough prediction. That IPCC document, International Panel on Climate Change, they've tried to project what temperatures would do in the future. It's a rough science. It's like economics trying to predict what's going to happen in the future. A better part of the science is that no one's figured out a way that it won't get warmer, or at least a way that sounds scientifically plausible, if CO2 keeps going up and other greenhouse gases. So, and the other thing is, climate is gradual. Climate is the sum of, over multiple decades, what the weather in a region is doing. So people don't think in terms of multiple decades. And people don't, it's like the probably totally false story about how you can put a frog in a pan of water and start increasing the heat until it boils. But because the heat increases so gradual, it never thinks to jump out in time. That's probably a bad analogy, but it's used a lot. And it's, I think frogs would actually jump. You do that experiment sometime. I think the frog, I think the frog will jump out. And I think humans probably will get it together. I think it's going to take another decade or so, for like this last 2 years, where it didn't get warmer. If that gets overcome and we see that in the long-term trend is continuing to get warmer overall, and people will see more and more effects, like the glaciers disappearing, and eventually it starts showing up in their utility bill or whatever, then eventually, I don't know if people are going to be convinced by the government telling them they got to do something. They've got to convince themselves through other reasons, either their own learning, education and learning, but also what the Earth starts telling them. I mean, people, the story is that people who live in more on the edge environments and ecosystems, like on the coast of parts of Alaska where it's permafrost in the ground, and the ocean with its waves is right there, or people and even nations that live on, that are little islands in the Pacific Ocean with the average height above sea level about from the floor to right here, they are already seeing loss of their land due to rise in sea level, which is due to increased temperatures. And they, you know, they think it's strange that other people are still arguing about whether it's even happening while they're losing their land or their country or having to move their village because the permafrost is melting and the ocean rising is eroding into the land that was their village. But most people don't live in places like that, at least most people in the United States. So it's going to, you know, they haven't seen that yet. Those are just stories. And you know, even using the global average temperature is a pretty poor measure, probably. Climates are not, I mean, the climate here is not the climate in Australia. Climates are local. So there are places on Earth that have cooled in the last 100 years for their average climate temperature. They're in the small minority, but climate isn't the same everywhere on Earth. And, you know, more than 9 out of 10 of the places on Earth where they've been keeping track have been warming up rather than cooling off for the last 100 whatever years. So people that live in those places have gotten a little bit colder, and they're probably not convinced, many of them, because it's hard to think statistically and average it all together into the larger whole. So, I don't know.
So could you say it's a problem that expands international boundaries?
Yeah, it definitely does.
Political boundaries.
It definitely. Yeah, thanks everyone for coming. We're out of time here. We should be going to dinner. But it definitely does. And different countries are doing different.